Have you come back very, very soon? Because you're down there following it closely.
So let me just shill for the Sierra Club. So oregon.sierraclub.org, and we have some information there, and we're going to be putting a lot more up. I did a blog post. My blog is on our homepage, and I did a blog post on September 23rd that goes into a lot of detail and has a couple of important reports linked to at the top.
Well, we will be putting links to all of this. We're going to be following this. We're going to be talking about this a great deal. Once we lose this coast, we lose it forever. This has been Air Cascadia Forum, Monday, December 15th to 2014. Kate Walsh engineered the show today. Thanks for that, Kate. Thanks also to our guest, Ted Gleichman of the Sierra Club. Thanks, Kathleen Stevenson, KBOOAM News and Public Affairs Director. I'm Chris Andrick. Get the facts, know your rights, take a stand. Thanks for listening and stay tuned.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Christmas Revels 2014, December 18th through the 23rd at St. Mary's Academy in downtown Portland. Christmas Revels is a popular form of seasonal production that features traditional dances, music, and songs in celebration of the winter solstice. Again, that's the Christmas Revels, Thursday through Tuesday, December 18th to the 23rd at St. Mary's Academy, 1615 Southwest 5th Avenue, Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This is Rita Christie, host of the Noontime Jamboree on the first and third Monday of each month. Please join me for vintage jazz, country, and western swing. That's on the Noontime Jamboree, the first and third Mondays from noon until 2 p.m. right here on KBOO.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Wilkin & Company, PC, Certified Public Accountants, helping businesses, individuals, and nonprofit organizations make financial decisions based on their personal values since 1987. Wilkin & Company is located at 2435 Southwest 5th Avenue in Portland. Information at 503-225-1359 or WilkinCPAS.com.
Good morning and welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. What do atoms have to do with your life? And how is it that even after we die, we continue to exist for eternity through our atoms as they disperse back into the universe? This morning we talk with Kurt Steiger, author of Your Atomic Self, The Invisible Elements That Connect You to Everything Else in the Universe. We'll look at how atoms provide a link between the physical world and the biosphere, and how that connection informs our relationship as biological beings to the physical universe. Kurt is an ecologist, paleoclimatologist, and science journalist who has published over 36 peer-reviewed articles in major journals and currently teaches at Paul Smith's College in the Adirondack Mountains of upstate New York. Kurt, welcome to Locus Focus.
Pleasure to be here.
Well, let's start by talking about where do atoms come from?
Well, it's amazing, you know. You see yourself, the kind of parts of the world you're familiar with, and you think, gosh, it's just so familiar and place based and local, and then you look up at the stars and it's not wonderful and they're distant, but actually we have a really direct connection to the stars that you can see out in space. So that's basically where all of the substance of our bodies come from, and the substance of every person we've ever known, every possession we have, and everything we see around us.
So how do those atoms that come from outer space wind up here on planet Earth and wind up inside our bodies?
Well, the first amazing thing that happens if you really burrow into this thing of being made of atoms is that space is right here inside of us and all around us, that atoms are mostly space. And basically the Earth we're on is floating in space too. And so we're basically made of atoms of the Earth from the rocks and the air and the water, but the Earth itself, of course, is floating in space and came from the exploded remains of a star that died roughly 5 billion years ago.
Well, as a kid, I was really fascinated with atoms and spent a lot of time, actually throughout my life, I've spent a lot of time musing about the kind of cosmically challenging idea of how small atoms are and how large the universe is, which is something I want to sort of address today as we talk about the relationship between ourselves and the atoms. But I guess one of the things that I sort of knew but was really refreshed in reading your book was how elements are actually formed within stars. And I wanted to talk a little bit about that because we all know about, I guess a lot of people know that in the sun, basically the sun is thermonuclear energy is caused by fusing two hydrogen atoms into a helium atom. But that only gets us to element number two. So how do we get to the rest of the whatever 94 or whatever naturally occurring elements in the universe?
Sure. It's sort of like that. It's nuclear fusion, which is basically, like you said, it's taking two atoms and smashing them together so they make larger atoms. But if you go up the list of elements that you're made of, they get larger and larger with more particles in their nucleus. And so you actually need something bigger than our sun to do that. Ours is kind of wimpy on the scale of sun stars. But if you get a real giant, it's got so much mass in the middle, and there's so much energy in there, you can just crunch bigger and bigger combinations together. So really, it's you sort of start out with hydrogen, and that's sort of the ancestor of all of your other elements that you're made of. And then if you have a large enough star, it lives fast and dies young. So it'll basically make larger and larger elements until it gets to the size of iron, which is a fairly sizable atom, and for various physical reasons, that's the limit. And the iron actually kind of becomes a poison that kills the star, makes it explode, and it spews the contents of the whole star out into space, which would include all the carbon and oxygen and nitrogen and other parts of your body as well.
Well, how do we get from iron to uranium?
Well, yeah, so that heavier stuff, the things like uranium and some of those larger elements as well, they have to be made usually when the star is actually exploding, because what basically happens is the star falls in on itself and whatever was inside there is sort of compressed and then blows outwards. And the shock wave that goes out through all the gas and dust is even more powerful and just briefly makes these sort of fireworks crackles where things like gold and silver and uranium will form as well, which then explains, well, gosh, the star was sort of making regular elements for a long time, and the production of gold and these other ones were only brief, and that's one of the reasons why gold and such elements are so rare.
And that includes, I imagine, what's called the rare earth elements as well.
Elements, yeah, exactly. So if you're wearing gold now, like a ring on your finger, let's say, I mean, that is a sign that a gigantic star died billions of years ago.
And same would be true for silver, which is what I'm wearing. But
there you go.
So how about the difference between stable elements or isotopes of elements and the radioactive ones? I mean, on the one hand, gold is considered a pretty stable element, but uranium has several isotopes that are highly unstable.
Yeah, well, if you figure if you're fusing these four little atoms together and smashing their innards into these combinations, some of them will be more stable than others. Some of them just can't hold themselves together, and they eventually spit out one or more little pieces from that nucleus that sort of then balances it out to something that is stable and will last a long time. So when that happens, the little pellet gets shot out like a bullet, you could say. That's what radioactivity is. It's radiating pellets of these atomic pieces outwards in all directions, trying to find a nice stable balance. It's almost like purging to lose weight, you could say, like that. So, but that's why these radioactive things can be dangerous, of course, because those pellets can smash into your genes or parts of your cells and cause damage.
Well, I want to start by talking about the common building blocks of the elemental building blocks of our bodies and where these elements came from. And then we can go from there into our connection back to the universe through these elements. But what are the essential elements that compose the human body?
Well, you could really boil it down to three of them. More than 9 out of 10 of your atoms are either carbon, hydrogen, or oxygen. And those come from the air, ultimately. So you're basically mostly condensed air. Most of your weight comes from water, of course, maybe almost 2/3 of your body weight. That's H2O. So every one of those little molecules of water is 3 atoms in one, a large oxygen with 2 little hydrogens perched on it, like little ears on Mickey Mouse's head, you could say. And that makes up almost 2/3 of your body. That came mostly from groundwater, which then fell out of the air in gas form. Water vapor is a major component of the air. And then about 1/10 of your body water came from the oxygen you breathe, which was pretty mind-blowing for me to find out, too. Like, you think, why do you breathe? Well, you know, helps you burn your food. But one of the waste products is the oxygen gas that you inhale eventually becomes part of your body water, about 1/10 of it. So you could say that 1 in 10 of the tears that roll down your cheeks were made from scratch by you, from atoms that came straight out of the air that you just breathed.
Now, how about those atoms that come from outer space? Where do those reside in our body?
Well, there are 2 main places. One of them is meteors. When you see the flash of a meteor through the sky, you say, gosh, look at that. Isn't that amazing? And it just burned up. Well, it's all gone. But it's actually not gone. If it was an iron metallic, let's say nickel iron meteor, all it did was vaporize with a lot of heat and light. And the atoms are still there. So there's actually a layer of cosmic iron atoms hanging around in the air, kind of like a fine mist surrounding the whole Earth. And eventually they kind of swirl down or settle down into the ground, go into the soil, and plants take them up and then use them for various parts of their cells. And then when animals or us eat those, we basically make our bodies out of that too. So some of the iron in your blood came right from outer space. And then some of your carbon atoms did that too. Basically, when stars are exploding all around us in the cosmos, some of those pellets hit air molecules and produce carbon-14, radioactive carbon-14, and that ends up passing through the food chains into your body. So you've got little radioactive cosmic carbons exploding all over your body like a fireworks show all the time as well.
And then we also use carbon-14 for dating how old anything organic is.
Yeah, it's an amazing thing. It's kind of like a blessing and a curse, because some of those carbon-14 explosions in your own body might be causing, you know, cancer or some kind of a damage, and there's really not much you can do about it. You could say, though, yes, it's great for carbon dating. That's how it works. And the other thing, of course, is the mutations that make evolution happen arise from that kind of thing as well. So basically, it's because of those things, you're yourself rather than some primordial blob.
Well, if you're just tuning in, we're talking this morning with Kurt Steger, who's the author of a new book called Your Atomic Self, The Invisible Elements That Connect You to Everything Else in the Universe. And so today we're talking about everything in the universe related to atoms and our connection through atoms to what's in the universe. Well, let's go through some of the other essential elements in our bodies and the atoms that compose them that come from outer space. What about calcium?
Well, calcium is one of the elements that you would not get from the air, one of the few. So a small percent of you is dirt. It's processed ground-up rocks, which came to you through plants that pulled them up through their roots and then you either eat the plants or you eat something that ate the plants. So, you know, if you sort of analyze your food, let's say, you know, you drink some milk or cheese, let's say there's a lot of calcium in that. That could be traced, let's say, to some cow who ate grass, which pulled those very same atoms out of the ground from crumbling rocks. And then you'll basically turn them back into rocks inside your body in the form of your bones and also other chemicals that you naturally use in your cells.
Well, it's besides our ability or our tendency to incorporate atoms from the, what we eat and the air and the water that we drink, we have this other kind of symbiotic relationship to other life forms on the planet, which have different processes of extracting elements and using them as food to feed themselves and ultimately to feed the rest of the planet. And I'm thinking about the whole process of photosynthesis and also nitrogen fixing, which are two things that plants do that we can't do. And I wanted to talk about let's start with photosynthesis first. And how actually photosynthesis is what changed the planet to be able to support life on the on a solid ground as opposed to in the ocean. And then we'll talk a little bit later about nitrogen fixing and how that also is part of this relationship that we have, the atomic relationship we have with the rest of the planet.
Sure. It's so transformative to look at your daily life on the level of the atoms because, you know, you say, well, I'm sitting here, I'm going to take a breath. Well, why did I do that? I don't know. Well, I guess to get some oxygen. Well, why is the oxygen in the air in the first place? And you think, well, it's just part of air. But really, it's unusual. Oxygen's not very stable. It's very reactive, which, of course, is why we breathe it. We use it to burn up our food, you could say, or metabolize our food. So even if we weren't here, you know, the oxygen would eventually be turned into rust and burn and all that kind of stuff. So the only reason it's here in the air is because living things are making it. Not the atoms, but the O2, the actual oxygen molecules. And so basically about half of the oxygen oxygen molecules you're breathing right now came from plants, and about half came from plankton in the oceans. So it's really, really interesting because the photosynthesis changes with the seasons, of course. Like right now, I'm looking out my window here in the Adirondacks, and the trees are asleep with snow on them. They're not making a lot of oxygen, but during the summer, they make a lot. And you can watch this if you could measure the amount of oxygen in the air around you through the seasons, and scientists do this. You can watch it almost as if the planet is breathing, where you get more and more oxygen in the air during the green months of summer in your half of the planet, and then drops down during the winter, and it just pulses up and down almost like a breathing machine in a way like that. And people that are looking for life on other planets right now, and we're finding lots of Earth-like planets, but what will really be a sign of life that you can see from here is if you can analyze the spectrum of the atmosphere, and if you see O2, oxygen gas on one of those distant planets, you can be pretty certain that something alive has made that.
Well, it's kind of curious to me that there was also, when I first learned that there was a period way, way back in the Earth's history where the atmosphere did not have oxygen and all life forms lived in the water. So how did our atmosphere turned to an oxygen-laden atmosphere, and what happened to all those creatures that had been dependent on breathing other stuff before that?
Yeah. Well, if you look at oxygen from our point of view, it's a great thing to have. But if you look back in time to the very first living things on Earth, there wouldn't have been very much of it. And it's actually very dangerous. It can kill your own cells, and we have ways of protecting ourselves from that. But it kills a lot of microbes, and what we're pretty sure happened was billions of years ago when certain kinds of bacteria learned how to do photosynthesis, they released their waste gas into the oceans, which then leaked into the air, and that would be oxygen. And it built up until eventually it changed the chemistry of the ocean and the atmosphere close to what it is today. From us, we'd say, well, isn't that great? They oxygenated the world for us. But you could also see it as the world's first massive global air pollution disaster. That we're not the only ones who can pollute our environment. You could see it as those cyanobacteria, the photosynthesizers, polluted their atmosphere, and the world I lived in, and anything that has survived since then is something that can handle that very dangerous, corrosive gas.
Well, another chemical or another element that's really important in our life is nitrogen, which is, of course, the most abundant element or compound in the atmosphere. But let's talk about how why we need nitrogen in our bodies and how we're able to get it.
Yeah, that's pretty amazing, too. You need nitrogen for a lot of things. You don't need much of it. Just a small percentage of your body is nitrogen atoms, but you got to have it because you build proteins with it and you build your genes with it and some of your enzymes as well. So it's kind of like when you build a house, well, you just think of the lumber and the bricks, but you also need the little nails and nuts and bolts that hold it together, and that's basically what nitrogen does. So you can't have your proteins and your genes without it. So it's vital. So you say, okay, well, where do we get that from? You think, well, the air is mostly nitrogen. Your oxygen's only about a fifth of it. So, you know, you're taking it in by the lungful with every breath. But ironically, you can't use it. It's in a form that's too... It's like to get the two atoms of nitrogen from a nitrogen gas molecule apart, you need the equivalent of a wrench to wrench them apart. And our cells just can't do it. So you pull them into your lungs and blow them out again like it was debris to get at the oxygen. So... But fortunately for us, early bacteria also figured out how to break those two atoms apart from the nitrogen gas. So they have these little enzymes that are like molecular wrenches, and they can pry those two atoms apart, make their own proteins and their genes out of them, basically. And then, when the cells are done with them, they release them as waste, like ammonia or things like that. And then plants and plankton can take them up, which is basically nitrogen fertilizer. So this is called nitrogen fixation. It's where you take this raw material, nitrogen gas, out of the air or the water and break it up and stick other atoms to it so it's in a biologically useful form.
Well, one of the things that I found interesting as I was reading your book, I was thinking about how some of these elements that are essential to life also can kill us. And you talked about iron being the death of stars. When they produce enough iron, then they kill themselves. And iron also can hurt us in too high a quantities. And we also know that, I mean, we are always talking about antioxidants in terms of fighting cancer or whatever, that, you know, we should be eating a lot of antioxidants, which would mean substances that would kill off the excess oxygen in our body. And also nitrogen, which has I don't know what it does in excess in our body, but certainly in waterways, it causes dead zones and all kinds of nasty things. So let's talk a little bit about this dual function that these elements have, that they're essential for life, but then too much of them will kill us, and how this is balanced or can be balanced in nature and in our bodies.
Sure. Well, I guess maybe to put it in the simplest terms, the answer becomes obvious if you really grasp that everything in the world and in the universe is made of atoms, which, frankly, I have difficulty doing. It's mind-boggling. It's like we're not made to be able to grasp this easily, but that's kind of what I'm trying to do in the book. So basically, think of anything that's bad for you, and atoms are doing it, and anything that's good for you, and atoms are doing it. So just, for example, you could look at some iron atoms in your body. What are they doing? Well, a lot of them are floating in your blood, in the hemoglobin. That kind of gives it the red color along with the other molecules. So you're using that. It's carrying oxygen for you. So that's great. And you have some enzymes floating around in your blood that use iron as a weapon, almost like carrying a sword. And when they come across dangerous molecules like hydrogen peroxide that sometimes forms in your cells, they chop them up with the sword made out of this iron atom. So you can see that happening when you get a cut. And if you pour hydrogen peroxide on a cut to sterilize it, you see the foam that comes up in the cut there. That's these enzymes in your blood destroying the peroxide as it's going into your body. So you killed the germs, but the enzymes are making sure the hydrogen peroxide doesn't hurt you. So those are defenses, but if you take too much, it's very reactive and can be poisonous. So your body basically carefully stores these iron atoms, almost like it's in cages and sheaths for these weapons. So, like, your hemoglobin is holding onto it tightly and just lets it carry oxygen for you. And these enzymes do the same thing. And any extra iron atoms just get soaked up by these little chemical sponges to protect you. And you know, you might be surprised to hear, you know, we take iron supplements to avoid anemia, but you have to be careful when you give it to children, because an adult dose of iron can actually sometimes be fatal for a child.
Well, how about oxygen, which also kind of has this dualistic nature?
Sure. Well, you think about it. You know, how does fire work? Well, you got to put oxygen in there. Okay, if you heat up wood or human tissues that are dry or a house in the presence of oxygen, it'll tear it apart. It'll burn it. It'll release heat and light and rip it down into individual atoms and molecules. If you put out a metal tool out into the elements, literally the elements, eventually the oxygen gas in the air will cling to it and tear it apart atom by atom. We'd call it rusting, but that's what it does. So we basically tame this wild creature in ourselves. We take it in and we bind it up with all the hemoglobin and all these other things and just channel it to our own ends. And basically take it into your cells and help it basically run the machinery that tears your food apart. So it's a danger, potentially dangerous thing. It's literally playing with fire, how we run our bodies.
Now, does it help to eat lots of blueberries and other antioxidants in order to control the exuberance of the oxygen in your body?
Oh, sure. You know, eating antioxidant food, and plus there are always many good reasons to eat blueberries. But, yeah, but your body is very good at that, too. Like, for example, I was saying that that enzyme that destroys hydrogen peroxide, we actually create a lot of these dangerous free radicals with oxygen that is in our body all the time because we're breathing and things like that as well. So we've got our own natural protections as well.
And I'm kind of curious about hydrogen peroxide. I didn't know about the way it was really bad for our bodies, but I have a friend who's a nurse who was telling me a few months ago that the latest studies are that you shouldn't be putting hydrogen peroxide on your cuts. But it sounds to me that from what you're describing, that our bodies have pretty good defenses, and hydrogen peroxide is a good antiseptic.
Yeah, when you see the foam, those are oxygen bubbles, oxygen gas, and every one of those atoms was torn off a hydrogen peroxide molecule by your protective enzyme.
So then it's just turned into water at that point.
So turns it into water and oxygen. Yeah.
So I shouldn't worry. I should continue to put hydrogen peroxide on my cuts.
It's way worse for the germs than for you.
Okay. Well, another thing that's really fascinating to me is how we use molecules and atoms of, let's say of carcasses of animals to be able to determine where they came from. And also, I guess we also can do this with fossils. And I've heard many stories about how the salmon in the Northwest basically shaped the forests. And it's been told by studying the nitrogen and also, I guess, the carbon atoms in the salmon. But you gave such an in-depth, elegant description of how on the chemical and on the physical level, the atomic physical level, that salmon have basically created the salmon forest of the Pacific Northwest. I wonder if you could talk about that and how we know that our forests here in the Northwest are shaped by salmon.
Sure. Yeah, again, that's what I try to do in the book, you know, not get too technical, but you have to get technical in a way, partly to show that we can now instead of only being intuitive about it. So it's well worth it. So you could say in simple terms, the way a scientist might say it, isotopic tracers show that marine nitrogen from salmon is common in forests in the Pacific Northwest. Okay, well, yeah. But think about it, say it another way. The atoms from the Pacific Ocean make the bodies of salmon.
And let's talk about what makes the isotopic difference in the nitrogen in the salmon in marine environments as opposed to terrestrial environments. And so how do we know, why is it that a certain isotope of nitrogen will be found more prevalently in the oceans and a different isotope will be found on solid ground?
Sure. So not all atoms are created alike. There are different versions of nitrogen in several other atoms as well. So there's one, the regular one, but there's a slightly heavy one called nitrogen-15. that you can just as well make your body out of, and things do, but it acts differently when the body finally breaks down. When bacteria eat the body, they basically release the normal lighter weight nitrogen more easily than they can the heavy one. And so the lighter stuff goes out, some of it vaporizes out of the ocean as ammonia gas, and basically what this amounts to is the oceans kind of get the slow buildup of that slightly heavier overweight form of nitrogen called nitrogen 15. So if you are an ocean-dwelling fish, which salmon are part of their lifetime, then the atoms you're making your body out of came through food chains that have extra N15 in them. And so you could actually probably weigh it. You know, you'd be a slightly heavier than you would be if you lived in fresh water. So there's a tracer. If these fish come up a river then and release their atoms into an environment on land and rivers and lakes and eventually the forests, you can watch the ratio of this heavy nitrogen spread from the dead bodies of the salmon through the bodies of the bears that eat them and make their bodies out of those same atoms, the carcasses that are left on the ground that the scavengers get and then poo the waste out or eventually die and release the atoms, and then the fungi and the plants that soak those same atoms up through their roots and into the trees, you start realizing, well, the forest and the things in it are made of atoms, and a lot of them came from the Pacific Ocean, from the bodies of the salmon. So it's really kind of neat, because a lot of folks sometimes see science as sort of the enemy of wonder and mystery and things like that, but boy, you know, there's no way of getting around it but saying that this is like shapeshifters and old mythology of one creature turning into another. I mean, basically, you could literally say salmon become bears, trees, and people in the Pacific Northwest.
Now, is that also true of us? Are we shaped in the same way by the foods that we eat? And can you tell from what the isotopes in what's in somebody's body where they've lived?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, there's a whole new form of atomic map that specialists are making of the world in the United States, where they map out these isotopic signatures with hydrogen isotopes, oxygen, carbon, and nitrogen isotopes. They call them isoscapes, where you find where there's more or less of this heavy version of the element. It has to do with the climate, mostly. You know, is it hot and dry is often what does it, but basically, then, you can identify oftentimes where drinking water came from, where a crop came from, even where a McDonald's hamburger came from, by measuring the isotopes that came from the groundwater and went through the food chains in that place. And then, of course, we also find it in people. Like some studies go around to barbershops around the United States and collect people's hair samples. And what you find out is you up in Portland, if you go to your barber there and measure the hydrogen isotopes, you have slightly heavier hydrogen isotopes up where you are than the people down the coast in Southern California do, because it's hotter and drier down there.
So why are our isotopes heavier?
It basically has to do with the fact that atoms are always jiggling. The more heat there is, the more they jiggle, and they're like little popcorn kernels popping in a popper. So if you have let's say water in a reservoir in a hot climate, Southern California, let's say, and the water molecules are jiggling faster because it's hot, then the lighter molecules will bounce higher out of the lake and evaporate away than the heavy ones will. So the heavy ones are left behind more, and then you drink them.
So we got more deuterium up here, is that what you're saying? Then
you'll get more of the deuterium, the heavy hydrogen, you'll get more heavy oxygen and things like that when it's hot and dry, so down south. So I may have misspoken there. I can't remember which I said, but you all will have lighter hair, lighter fingernails, lighter drinking water than you would down in Southern California.
So we've got the H2O and they've got the D2O. Is that? If you're just tuning in, we're talking this morning with Kurt Steger, who's author of Your Atomic Self, The Invisible Elements That Connect You to Everything Else in the Universe. In the last few moments of the show, I'd like to talk about our relationship to pollution and maybe also to climate change as trace through the elements and the atoms in our body. So you talk about all these mystical cosmic atoms that go through our body, but what is our relationship to that coal fire plant down the road or across the ocean in China?
Sure. Yeah, well, again, you know, you can just sort of say in an intuitive way, oh, all the world's connected, no man is an island, but it's literally atomically true. So as we were saying, most of your atoms come from the air, and your carbon all eventually comes from the air. It's from carbon dioxide that plants take up in algae, and they make it into solid form, and then things eat them, and those same atoms that were floating in the air, carbon atoms, eventually end up being what you make your body out of. About a quarter of your body weight is carbon atoms that came from the air. All right, so if we contaminate the air with fossil fuel carbon, that means you're contaminating the source of your atoms. And sure enough, there are isotopic signatures. It's relatively low abundance of heavy carbon 13 in fossil fuels. The more that we put into the air, the lighter, you could say, the less heavy the carbon dioxide in the air is. And that gets transferred to the isotopic composition of all life on Earth, including us. So if you did an analysis of your carbon atoms, like if you look at the back of your hand, there's your fingernails. Okay, those are full of carbon atoms there. If you analyze that, your isotopic composition is different from what your grandparents would have had and their grandparents before them. You're basically making your body out of fossil waste gases.
So is that bad for our health? I mean, is it as bad to be full of these fossil fuel-produced carbon atoms as it is to be, let's say, inhaling PAHs?
Right. No, because atoms don't remember what they used to be. So just because, one-eighth of the carbon atoms in your body came out of a smokestack or tailpipe may seem unsettling, but there's nothing directly unhealthy about that. I mean, a lot of your atoms used to be dinosaur breath and other things too. But what it does is it's an almost hair-raising reminder that we are made of the atmosphere that we pollute. And so although these carbon atoms themselves may be harmless, there are other things mixed in there as well, like lead and mercury that are also going up there, which also are ending up in our bodies. And you could say the carbon is a tracer there. And also, for those of us that don't believe humans can change the chemistry of the atmosphere and make climate change happen, this is an undeniable atomic reminder that it's actually true, because you can measure the chemistry of your own body changing.
So that's how we can prove that we're doing it as opposed to the volcanoes?
Absolutely. Yeah, we're hundreds of times more powerful than volcanoes now in that sense.
Well, one thing that was really fascinating, you talk about the connection between the distant past when the fossil fuels we burn today were the plant, mostly I guess the plant life that the dinosaurs ate that got compressed into oil. And so that we're sort of living on two time zones. There's the present that we're living through, but then and the polluting that we're doing, but it's coming from this very ancient time. So I want to talk about how the atoms in those in the fossil fuel that we're burning today connects us to this distant past.
Yeah, we think of these things as unnatural. Oh, oil and petroleum and plastic, how unnatural! But really, it's the atoms from the bodies of ocean plankton. They're living things, just like what we see today. And coal that we burn is ancient firewood. So really, it's basically bringing the dead back to life from millions and millions of years ago. It's basically compressed air and sunlight from days before there were people, even before there were mammals, that are still, buried there in the earth. We dig them up, throw them back in the air by burning them, and then they enter the realm of life again, joining the food chains, and are not only among us, but they become us as well.
Well, in your book, you have this kind of cool, almost detached way of describing on the atomic scale all these things that some people might consider the horrors of our present. And whether you talk about nitrogen fixing, and you talk about the basically the discovery that we could create our own fertilizer and we didn't have to rely on the microorganisms to do the nitrogen fixing for us. And I think, and I've been reading a lot of books lately, so I might be confused. I think you made a mention of the Green Revolution. And that really changed the ability for us to feed ourselves. There's a lot of people who are very much focused on local food production today and growing things organically who do not think the Green Revolution was a good thing. And also it basically sputtered out. And there's also the whole, when you talk about pollution, we can just go look at it. Oh, this is just, you know, these are the same atoms and it's all kind of cosmic. But in your book, you seem to take, I would say, kind of a moral stand at some point about the role that humans are playing in either destroying the Earth or maybe finding some ways to preserve it, at least until it has its own timely death. So I want to talk a little bit about that struggle in being a scientist of like looking at things objectively, you know, almost like from the wrong end of a telescope, to being more immersed in all the ethical implications.
Sure. It's utterly transformative, because basically what science is doing is laying a firm structural foundation beneath ethical and intuitive things that we've known from earlier traditions through time. And basically, the main thing that it challenges is the idea that humans are separate from nature. And really, you could boil down most of our environmental problems to that myth. We can now show, by looking on the atomic scale, that that is an illusion. We are literally, elementally, a part of the Earth itself. And basically, the Earth makes us what we are, and we make the Earth what it is. And anything we do to the world we live in not only affects other living things and the Earth itself, it also affects us, because the atoms of our bodies are coming and going all the time from this giant shared reservoir. So to go through the nitty-gritty of tracing where the atoms in your body come from, what do they do inside you, and where they go, I think is at the rock bottom of what ecology is and what environmental responsibility is, because you find out there's no place to throw your waste to that's really away where it's never going to affect anything again. And it also shows a kinship, a literal physical kinship to the Earth and all life on Earth, that being social primates that we are, feeling that you are kin changes how you see yourself in relation to other things and how you react to it. So I feel like getting a better sense of your atomic self really is an important thing to do nowadays, as the Earth is becoming more and more, you know, conjoined with the human race.
Well, Kurt, it's really great talking to you, and I really enjoyed reading your book, and it brought back all that mystery about the cosmos and the insides of atoms that I felt when I was a child. So it's nice to have that curiosity rebirthed again.
Wonderful.
So thanks for joining us, and I definitely recommend this book by Kurt Sager, Your Atomic Self, The Invisible Elements That Connect You to Everything Else in the Universe, particularly if you want to get a new take on what makes you tick. So thanks again, Kurt, for being on Locus Focus.
Thank you.
And we've been talking with Kurt Sager, author of Your Atomic Self, The Invisible Elements That Connect You to Everything Else in the Universe. And you've been listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed, or you want your friends or family to hear this show, you can listen to it online or download the audio later this afternoon on our website, kboo.fm/locusfocus. Next week, we'll talk with Ted Genoways about the exploding development of the Canadian tar sands and how that connects to the future of the Keystone Pipeline. Keystone XL pipeline. My engineer is Kate Welch. I'm Barbara Bernstein. We're going to go out with some music by Kate and Anna McGarrigle. Thanks for listening.
Just a little atom of chlorine, valence minus one, swimming in the scene, just having fun. She's not worried about the shape or size of her outside shell. It's fun to ionize just a little atom of Cl with an unfilled shell. But somewhere in that sea lurks handsome sodium, with enough electrons on his outside shell, plus that extra one. Somewhere in this deep blue sea, there's a negative for my extra energy. Yes, somewhere in this foam, my positive. Thank you.
magnetic pull. She looked down and her outside shell was full. Sodium cried, what a gas, be my bride, and I'll change your name from chlorine to chloride. Now the sea evaporates to make the clouds for the rain and snow, leaving her chemical compounds in the absence of H2O. But the crystals that wash upon the shore are happy ones. So if you never thought before, think of the love that you eat when you salt your meat.
And it's 11 a.m. on KBOO Portland. Coming right up, KBOO speaks with three residents of rural Washington County who have organized a petition to oppose the expansion of the urban growth boundary without a public process. At 11:30 on the Radio Zine, host Dan Johnson speaks with Don Horn of Triangle Productions about five lesbians eating a quiche. And I want to thank you all for listening to KBOO Community Radio, and thanks KBOO members for your generous support that keep this station on the air. There's a couple announcements before we go to that interview with the Washington County folks about the urban growth boundary.
New and increased donors are being matched in December at KBOO. All donations from new donors and all increased annual donations from current members will be matched one-to-one by generous foundations and individuals up to $10,000 in December 2014. That means a $35 new or increased membership will become $70, and a $100 donation increase will become $200 in support. Thank you for keeping KBOO strong by making a generous gift online at kboo.fm or by dropping by or mailing your gift to the station at 20 Southeast 8th, Portland, Oregon 97214. Spread the word and tell your friends why you support KBOO and ask them to consider becoming members.